Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of November 16th. This week I'm joined by Father Kevin Burke, the Executive Dean at the Jesuit School of Theology of Santa Clara University in California. Welcome, Father Burke.
Thank you.
Now, we're here to talk about an event that happened exactly 20 years ago, November 16th, 1989. Perhaps, Father Burke, you can just kind of introduce us to the tragic events that happened on that day in El Salvador, and where were you when it happened?
This is an event that certainly Jesuits and Friends of the Society of Jesus, people who work at Jesuit schools, people familiar with Jesuits, and of course anybody in the Catholic Church and throughout the populace of the United States would have been aware of 20 years ago, when six Jesuit priests and two women, a cook and her daughter, were murdered by members of the Salvadoran army on the campus of the University of Central America in San Salvador. The Jesuits included the president of the university, Father Ignacio Ea Correa. It included the vice rector or vice president of the university and the rector of the Jesuit community, Father Ignacio Martin Baró and Father Segundo Montes, three other priests and the two women. They were killed by soldiers of the Salvadoran army, although that fact didn't come to light in the American press immediately, because El Salvador at that time was engaged in a fairly tense civil war. The United States government was supporting the Salvadoran government and its army in that war against the guerrillas or the insurgency called the FMLN. And there was an active campaign in the city of San Salvador that November, which created a situation of national emergency, and it gave the army, the Salvadoran army, the pretext of going onto the university grounds and murdering these innocent civilians. The reasons for that are themselves interesting. The whole background and history of the event is interesting. But it's also helpful just now at a distance of 20 years to step back and simply try to imagine the overwhelming power of such an event, the effect that it had, for example, on those of us in the United States. I remember very clearly the morning of November 16th. I was a young priest, a campus minister at Regis University in Denver, Colorado, and I came into the office early in the morning and was met by the director of campus ministry, Sister Ann Goggins, with the news that six Jesuits had just been found murdered in El Salvador. I was, of course, stunned by the news as I looked at the names and recognized several of them. They were not anyone whom I had personally met. I knew Jesuits who knew these men very well. I myself had been following the events in El Salvador, as had most Jesuits in the United States, for any number of years. And so when this event occurred, I must say, now looking back, as the immediate shock began to wear off, what it felt like was a death in the family. These were our brothers. And it was not just a death, it was a multiple death, and not just a death, but a murder. And as it became clearer that our country was both involved in the sense of offering actual financial and military support to the government whose army had perpetrated this crime, and then also as it became clearer that our government tried to help cover up the crime, with the sense of shock also a sense of both outrage and a need to respond ethically and morally.
Now, there were six total priests killed?
Yes, there were six priests killed. The three that I named, Fathers Ea Correa, Montes, and Martin Baró, two other priests who were working at the university, Father Armando Lopez and Juan Ramon y Moreno, and then a sixth Jesuit, a retired Jesuit, who had worked with a program called Fe y Alegría, a program for teaching young children, Father Joaquin Lopez y Lopez, was killed after the first five had been killed. And then they heard the noise of two women who were reacting to the murder. They were staying in a house right next to the Jesuit community, and they were staying there, ironically, to get away from their house right on the street, because there had been so much shooting the night before. They thought they would be safer inside the university grounds. Of course, The irony is that they were precisely in harm's way by virtue of that. And because the army did not want to leave any witnesses, they also killed these two innocent women.
You have written two books and also your dissertation on Ignacio Ellacuría, who was at the university and obviously was one of the murdered priests. What can you tell about, just give us a picture of him and his theology and how that played into his ultimate murder?
In many ways, I would say, and I wouldn't be alone in this assessment, that Father Ellacuría was the key target of this attack. And actually, the timing of the attack bears out that point. Father Ellacuría had been in Spain for some time, for several weeks, just immediately prior to this. In fact, interrupted his trip to Europe to come back because there had been an assassination of a group of union leaders, and the president of the country, President Cristiani, asked Father Ellacuría if he would be part of a commission that investigated that murder. And so he came back into the country, and his presence in the country had been ascertained by the security forces, who searched the new Jesuit residence where these priests were living. They had just moved into this residence about a week before. The security forces searched it just 2 days before the actual event. Father Ellacuría judged, and I think he made a mistake in this judgment, that because they came onto the campus and saw that nothing was wrong, they're had nothing to worry about. As a matter of fact, what he didn't get was that this was like a reconnaissance mission and that they were being targeted. They had been on death lists for so long that they had probably come a bit inured to the possibility of their own murder. Even though they had seen Archbishop Romero killed 10 years before, they had seen the American church women raped and murdered in 1980. Their own companion, Rutilio Grande, had died back in 1977. And many other priests and many other pastoral workers had been targeted for assassination. So Father Ellacuría perhaps made a mistake there. He was a guy not given to too many mistakes. He was a brilliant man. He was an accomplished philosopher and theologian. He was an extraordinary administrator. It's amazing to me to think that this man was able to be the president of the university, the editor of two of its major publications, and during the years that he was president of the university, still managed to publish nearly 100 scholarly articles, an extraordinary output. He was involved in all kinds of things during the war years. After the assassination of Bishop Romero, along with the new bishop, at that time, Bishop Riveri Adames, he was one of the real visible leaders in the church. And for example, in 1985, when the daughter of the president, then president, Duarte, was captured by the guerrilla, it was Father Ellacuría who helped to negotiate her release. There were many, many other things that he was involved in, but what I've been so impressed by, and I studied his theology and philosophy after his death, I never had the chance to meet him in this life. I've come to know him through this brilliant output that of writings that he left behind. What I've come to see is that he had a profound and integrated and deeply Ignatian vision, not only of the ministry and the mission of the university, but a kind of a vision of life itself, of the world. He talks about a philosophy of historical reality and a theology which corresponds to that and which takes seriously the way God and God's will is being revealed and or thwarted in our actual historical circumstances in any given place, in any given time in human history. And so Ellacuría's own theology, his own way of approaching the truth of Jesus Christ, posed a threat to those who wanted to create an ideological version of reality and to secure their own position of wealth and power by imposing that ideological vision. And the real crime of the community, of the university community, the real crime, put that in quotation marks, of these Jesuits was that they dared to tell the truth about what was going on in their country, and they dared to proclaim the truth of the Christian gospel in the face of that reality.
Now, there were actually two Jesuits who lived in that community but were not there on the night when their colleagues there were killed, including John Sobrino, who some of our listeners may be familiar with. So He just happened to be traveling on that day?
Yes. The two priests, Father Rudolfo Cardinale, was staying in a community across town in a suburb of San Salvador called Santa Tecla. Father Sobrino was actually out of the country. He was in Thailand attending a theological conference of Asian theologians. So it was just simply a scheduled visit out of the country. He would have been another key person that the military leaders wanted to eliminate. And as a matter of fact, his surviving this event put him in the, I would say, unenviable position of being like the key theological witness to what it was these men stood for, what it was they gave their lives for, and who was the Lord that they served. Sobrino himself is a great theologian, as you imply, and his work in Christology and ecclesiology, his writings on martyrdom, are some of the most important theological writings, I would say, in the church of these last two decades.
The term liberation theology for a lot of people is, I think some people take it in different ways. In what ways, both Sobrino and A. Correa, how would they define liberation theology?
Yeah, that's actually a good question, and there's a good answer to that question in a very fine essay by Father A. Correa entitled The Church of the Poor, Historical Sacrament of Liberation. It appears in English in a very fine volume by Orbis Books called Mysterium Liberationis. In that article, the very first paragraph is like a definition, a dense definition, I might add, of liberation theology, in which he basically says, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't have it in front of me, but he basically says, this theology attempts to read the truth of the story of Jesus from the faith of the people who follow Jesus in history and who continue his project in history. His project, of course, being the proclamation of the kingdom of God. And so it's a reflection from faith on the faith of the people of the Church of El Salvador who have been animated by the Spirit of the risen Christ. And actually, that definition of, quote, liberation theology is a very good definition of what I would call any theology in a truly Ignatian key. That is, Ignatian spirituality, as you know, seeks to find God in all things, seeks to actually experience and encounter the living God in our own lives, in our own history. Well, this is a theology that follows upon or reflects upon that encounter of God in history, that finding of God in all things.
Now, going back to something you mentioned before, if we go back in time to when these deaths occurred and the United States' own involvement in perhaps covering it up, what exactly happened there and when did the truth finally come to light?
Immediately after the Jesuits were killed, there were a number of what I would call generally ambiguous statements from the U.S. State Department, basically saying, we don't know who did this. As a matter of fact, the Army soldiers left behind some crude signs that said, you know, death to the Jesuits, signed by the FMLN. So they tried to cover their tracks and pin the blame on the guerrillas. It didn't take very long, and it didn't take any time at all for people in El Salvador to just see that that was ridiculous. The campus had been surrounded by a large number of army troops and tanks. There was no way the guerrilla could have come on the campus. That was not as obvious up here, and so that kind of uncertainty remained for a while. Sometime in January of 1990, the case began to crack when a U.S. colonel who had inside information from a friend in the Salvadoran army began to tell some other people what he had discovered. And not long after that, there was a congressional committee appointed, a bipartisan committee, headed by a Massachusetts congressman named Joseph Moakley. And that commission began to investigate and try to find out exactly what happened. It took almost a year before the case fully broke. The Moakley Commission had to do a lot of backtracking and uncovering of things that were being covered up to figure out what had happened. The story of all of that is told, I think, brilliantly in a very balanced way by a journalist by the name of Teresa Whitfield in a book called Paying the Price that was published in 1994. After 5 years of research on this book, she put out a story that weaves the basic life story of Ignacio A. Correa into the story of the murder of these six priests and the attempted cover-up in order to try to understand what was really going on in El Salvador. It still remains kind of the best work that has been published, to my knowledge, about this horrible event.
Now, it's been 20 years, and you have visited El Salvador in that time. What has changed in the country since then? What remains the same? What's going on?
It's actually a good question, and as you might guess, it's a very complex question, not easily answered. But I would say this is just in a kind of very brief way. One of the immediate impacts of the death of these Jesuits was it changed the course of U.S. foreign policy toward El Salvador. It caused our government to begin exerting a lot more forceful pressure on the Salvadoran government to negotiate an end to the civil war that had been going on since 1979. That war was finally ended in late 1992. The peace accords were signed in January of 1993. There were investigations of various things. There was a tribunal that investigated the war crimes of that era that published the definitive account of who was responsible for the deaths of the Jesuits. And, of course, that is continuing now. There's a case that's been filed in Spanish court to try some of the intellectual authors of this crime in Spain because, of course, five of the six Jesuit victims of the crime were originally Spanish citizens. There were a number of other things that changed in the country. So the war itself ended, and there was a period of relative calm in the mid-90s. My first visit to El Salvador in 1993, in some ways the country felt a little bit more secure then than it did in subsequent years because the war ended, but the country was rife with guns. It became a place where the drug trade started to flourish, where gangs and organized crime began to take effect. The government that was in charge for a number of years, basically the offspring of the same government that had been in power at the time of the deaths of the Jesuits, would promise change, but the change was superficial. So you can see differences. The highway from the airport itself, looks a lot more modern than it did 20 years ago. The cathedral has been fixed up. There are other superficial changes. But the deep social inequities, the reality of poverty, the fundamental inequity of the country remains the same. However, for the first time in all these years, another party was elected in the last general elections in El Salvador. It still remains to be seen whether that will signal any significant change in the actual course that the country follows. And I think to a great extent, it's hard to put too much on just the election of a government. I think the kind of deep social change that needs to happen in El Salvador and in much of our world is tied to the larger issues that are addressed, for example, by Catholic social teaching and most recently by Pope Benedict in his most recent encyclical, the kind of real change that takes seriously the history of our world and our Christian commitment to build a different kind of world for the future.
Finally, maybe we can end by discussing, you mentioned John Soprano earlier. It's interesting, somebody who really has to carry kind of the weight of these deaths because he was not there. He's also, as a theologian, somebody who's looked to kind of continue, in some ways, their legacy. How has that been for him? Do you know him? He's also been under investigation by the Vatican. We wrote about this about a year ago. How are things for him these days?
Well, I first met Father Soprano actually in 1990, about 6 months after the deaths of the Jesuits. He was the graduation speaker at the college where I was working in Denver, Regis University. And I have to say, that year Regis University had the greatest graduation speaker in the world, bar none. I mean, you couldn't have asked for a more powerful address than the survivor of that horrible massacre speaking about the meaning of the Christian message and what it means to graduate from a Jesuit school in this world. I will never forget the impact that listening to his remarks had on me and then my own personal conversations with him. I think it really changed the direction of my own future studies. I think I can go back to that conversation and pinpoint it as a turning point when I had decided that if my superior sent me back to doctoral studies, as we were discussing at that time, that I would focus on the theology of of Sobrino and Aya Correa. John is, I would say, you know, in one way, his health has not been great in recent years during the period in which he was being investigated by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. He took a real sharp turn negatively in his own health. He was really sick there for a while. But when I saw him last spring, I saw him earlier this year in the spring, he looked better than he had seemed in years. There was a kind of a peace there. He had gone through this period of investigation. I think it's important to say he was not in any way condemned by the church. Questions were raised about his theology, and there are questions about this kind of theology, about liberation theology. I think this is actually a good thing. I think it would be a little bit frightening if Jesuit theologians were not pushing the envelope, because that's the service we provide the church. And so it's not surprising that in everything from science and religion to the relationship with other religions to the relationship with historical suffering, the Jesuit theologians really probe deeply new ways to express our ancient faith. And that, at times, is going to raise eyebrows and concerns. And it's going to be for history to judge just where this movement called liberation theology, or particular theologians like John Sobrino, will stand. I personally would suspect that Sobrino will be remembered as one of the great theologians of the late 20th and early 21st century in the Catholic Church.
Well, I just made reference to that special issue we had on Christology in wake of the announcement of the investigation of John Sobrino, and you contributed to that symposium. It appeared on September 17th, 2007. That's free on our website for those who are interested. We want to thank Father Kevin Burke for talking about this difficult moment in the history of the Jesuits, but also kind of bringing us up to speed on what's going on in El Salvador.
Thank you very much for inviting me to join you.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's America Magazine podcast. A reminder to look online for other features, including a review of the work of the artist John Lafarge Sr. by Leo O'Donovan. We also have our online video commentary this week, which we will be doing every week, from Kevin Clark on the situation in Afghanistan. A reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.